begin taping. My goodness, we're only 5 minutes late. That's not bad for this room being full of about a zillion little kids about 5 minutes ago. I'm Bill Lennon, and today we're going to talk about sexual addiction. And I put under there, can Christians have it? And my theme will be that anybody can have it. So I'll tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then I'll tell you, and then I'll tell you what I told you. Because the idea that I will talk with you about today and listen to you about today is the idea of a disease model, much like alcoholism. There are a number of breakdowns, but there are also a number of comparisons with alcoholism. So, you know, we can't stay all the way with alcoholism, but at least we can make some comparisons. And the reason I like to refer to alcoholism is that most of us have a fairly good grasp of what alcoholism is all about. We have either dealt with that issue ourselves or have dealt with some people who've dealt with that issue. So it gives us a frame of reference to work with. Actually, this thing that we're calling sexual addiction fits closer to eating disorders. And the reason I like to make a comparison with all three, because there are more similarities with chemical dependency and sexual addiction and eating disorders. There are more similarities than differences. There are breakdowns. I don't pretend that there aren't. It's much easier to get some kind of control over a chemical that you put in to your system than it is to get control. And I'll talk much more about that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, when we get into the treatment modality of how we actually treat this particular disease entity. I started working with this problem, or a version of this problem, in 1979. And I was in Tacoma, Washington, and kind of got in through the back door. Actually, a counselor who'd been working with a program that folded due to some very complex reasons came to the counseling center that I had started and said, oh, can I do this particular work here? And at that time, this particular work, and I want to make a real clear differentiation for all of you here today, that particular work that he was talking about was working specifically with child molesters. And so we began in 1979 a family incest treatment program. And at that time, we worked with a very select group of people. The select group of people we were working with were families that had been at Western State Hospital, or at least the offender had been at Western State Hospital, which in the state of Washington at that time was the primary inpatient treatment program for people who'd broken the law, were adjudicated, were sent to Western State Hospital, went through their program, and then, for whatever their own reasons, chose to reunite with their families. And we were working with them. So I got to learn about some of that, almost by being forced to learn about it. And I say that because in 1979, there just weren't little workshops like this being run. I mean, you just couldn't find much to learn about. There were some, but not too many. Some in Denver and some in Massachusetts were the only two that I knew of, Gene Abel and Nicholas Groth, but not very many, really. At any rate, in 1983, I went to a conference in Los Angeles and spent a week at a conference with Pat Carnes, who wrote this book that I'm suggesting that anybody that has any interest in here buy this book. At least I've had the bookstore people bring it, several of them. And he actually wrote this, Carnes wrote this book in the first, Out of the Shadows, Understanding Sexual Addiction. And he wrote this one, actually, Pat wrote this book in 82 and didn't publish it till 84 because he didn't have the nerve to publish it, is what he said. I mean, this was such a far-fetched kind of addiction, sexually. I mean, what does that mean, and how could it be, and that sort of thing. Since this book is more anecdotal, I think it's a good book. It's CompCare. they're the folks that put out all the much work on chemical dependency. But what Carnes did, he comes from a background as a family therapist and a chemical dependency counselor. And basically what he did was take what he could see in terms of understanding the disease of sexual addiction from chemical dependency and the family systems approach and switched it over and put it into this thing called sexual addiction. And as I said, that's a very anecdotal book. The good thing about it is that his illustrations are very clear. They're graphic, they're specific. It's sometimes I've heard people say, well, I can't relate to that because the examples are too extreme. And so if you read that, it's important to read it and understand that he gives pretty far out on a continuum examples. Like he talks about the itinerant junior high school music teacher, a female who had 3,000 sexual contacts in a 2 or 3 year period of time, because she would, as she went from school to school, she could, you know, there wasn't any accountability particularly, so she would have sex with someone before she got to her first school, and she was way far into the addiction, and then maybe have sex with someone between schools, and then because she was very music, she was a music teacher in public school. She would go sing in bars at night and pick someone up and have sex with someone. Do you see what I'm saying? That's a pretty extreme example. And some people can read it, but wait a minute, I don't know anybody like that. So you have to look at that on a continuum. Carnes wrote this book, which basically has the things in it that this has. There's some differences. This is the one I have up here. I think this really gives you a nice overview of what this problem is. I would encourage, if you have any interest in this, I encourage people to have this in their library, have access to it. They're good books. While I'm pushing books, last week I was pushing this book, Marie Fortune's book, who's also, she's a pastor in Seattle, Is Nothing Sacred When Sex Invades the Pastoral Relationship? And we're not going to talk much about, I don't think, maybe in the forum tonight, because you don't know where a forum goes. But I'm not going to talk much about this one this week, but I really highly encourage this book, too, for any people who want to have some kind of an understanding of what can and often does happen in the patriarchal system that we set up, where pastors are very different from their parishioners and can't get the supportive kind of help sometimes that they need, and the parishioners get into a real codependent kind of role, and some of the things you can do about that. I also have some other books here, which I'll talk just more, but since I'm running books, I've got the Sexaholics Anonymous book, which I think is an excellent resource. It's a good book. These aren't for sale, I'm just mentioning them. Here's a book, What Everyone Needs to Know About Sex Addiction. It's actually, this book is a shortened version of The Hope and Recovery, a 12-step guide for healing from compulsive sexual behavior. And they've taken some of the examples out of here just to help some people who are absolutely, totally floored. And I'll talk in a minute about how the secret world keeps you totally floored. But when you find out that for the last 22 years, all of a sudden someone that you've lived with, who you know intimately in 9/10 of their life and in 1/10 of their life, all of a sudden you're finding out there's a whole other world that's been going on. And that's somewhat what this book speaks to. It gives one case history of a male and of a female who were caught into this quote-unquote disease model. This is a really nice book, Back from Betrayal, Recovering from His Affairs. Jennifer Schneider is an MD, really nice lady. She's an internal medicine person in Phoenix. And Bert, her husband, is a classic sexual addict, and his sexual addiction pattern was to be in numerous affairs. And in the last, let's say they're in about 3 years of recovery now. And anyway, she wrote this book. And that's obvious. A certain strata of people, this is a really helpful resource for. And then I have some books here that I just recommend Melody Beattie's book on codependence, which it looks like I didn't bring down with me, and Ann Wilson Chafe's book, Codependence, Misunderstood, Mistreated. It almost becomes abusive when you say it, but Carnes' belief is, and I certainly believe it too, that there is the disease of sexual addiction. There is also the disease of codependency that goes with sexual addiction. And as difficult as it is to say, and I hope I can say it objectively and not in a blaming kind of way, is that in Melody Beattie's book, Codependent No More, she talks about it particularly on the alcohol model. But if someone is alcoholic and are dependent on the chemical, and their partner has been with them for a number of years, then we know that the partner is in a dependent slash codependent role with the alcoholic, because they support that role. Now, when you first talk to them, they may say, what in the world are you talking about? What do you mean I support that role? But their inability to recognize the signals and to stop the behaviors. Often what happens in the sexual addiction issue with the codependent partner is the codependent partner becomes often even immobilized with the idea, well-intentioned but never functional, that if I did this, this, or this, or didn't do this, this, or this, then he wouldn't do that anymore, if we use the male-female. So if I were more sexual, or if I were more touching, or if I were more caring, or if I were, and you just fill in the blank, which, see, has nothing to do with anything, because as I'll talk now in just a minute about this particular disease entity, it really has nothing to do with the partner. It really has nothing to do with the partner. And I'm referring now to males. In the groups that we run, I think we've got four groups now, we're probably working with, we keep our groups, and I'll talk more about that on Thursday, how we set our groups up and what we do. But we're working with, 35 to 50 people at any given time dealing with this particular entity. And I don't ever find it having anything to do at all with the partner. And most of the people we have are males, for whatever reason. I don't think that this problem is somehow male-oriented. I think that right now, it's in the beginning stages of being able to work with this problem, and more males are coming forward. Whatever. You know, you figure the mores as well as I can. I don't know. But I don't think there's anything just about me. And I don't think I have any groups that we don't have some women in. We just don't have as many women. So when I use the term male, I'm not trying to pick on men. It's just that I work more with men with this particular problem. I want to define addiction as I'm using it for just a minute. I've got five parts of it. I was tickled to notice, in fact, I was reading, you know, I get this tons of stuff, I go to all these workshops, and I was reading something through this morning, which tickled me, because I said, hey, that's my definition. And, I don't know if I can grab it right now, but in our business, to get insurance payments, we have to put a little code number on, and there isn't any code number in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Sexual Addiction. Now, we're in the third revision. There has been one written for the fourth revision, and whether it'll be accepted or not, I don't know. But it includes these components to be sexually addicted. One of the components is that it's a repetitive act. It has to be something that you just go back to and you do over and over. I'm always thinking of it in terms of this concept is a little bit hard to get across, but it may go over and over very rapidly. The whole cycle, and I'll talk in a minute about the cycle, may take place in 2 minutes. Or it may take place in 2 years. And probably with the sexual addict, both are working at the same time, always. Did I throw you on that? Did that make any sense? A fellow gave me a... Okay, I'm getting 2-3 nods and a couple of no's, so... I got so much material I want to cover, but at least do, you know, stop me, yell, wait a minute, what in the world are you talking about? I'll give you two examples. One fellow that I worked with who is in strong recovery, does not want this pattern, and it is repetitive. What he would find as he would deliver auto parts in the city that he worked in, he had one of these things, he was a delivery person, he would work his way in because he would know that at auto parts shops, there is a little moire that in the back room, there's always pictures of naked women. And he learned that in auto shops. And I don't know, is that true? Does anybody know? Anybody go into auto shops? There's lots of pictures of Playboy and Penthouse and foldouts and all like that. So he would work his way around as he would go from shop to shop to shop where he would deliver his parts. He would gradually work his way where he could get into the back rooms. Now, he might know that he wasn't going to get into this back room for 3 months and for this back room for 6 months, but there was that little bit of charge always working that he knew that was coming. So that's kind of a long-term kind of thing. Another fellow gave me an example one time of playing Scrabble. Two couples playing Scrabble at someone's house, and I've jumped ahead, so if the intensity of this is like, how could that be that intense? Remember that I pulled the example a half an hour earlier than I should have. They were playing Scrabble, and he had to go to the bathroom. Well, while it wasn't his turn, he wanted to go to the bathroom. Now, that means three other people are going to make a move, so he's got, you know, 2, 3, 5 minutes or something. He went into the bathroom to go to the bathroom. He saw a stack of Penthouse magazines, and he was just absolutely struck with the need to look and masturbate and get back into the room before anybody would know. And the things that he was going through were, if I don't do it, I lose this chance, and I may never get this chance again. And there is an intensity around the addiction that if you don't have addictive kinds of issues in your life, you just may not be able to understand. And he was transferred to the point where he wrestled with it for about 3 minutes. Chose not to do it that time, but didn't even go to the bathroom. He just got all caught up in all the conflicting intensity of emotions, knowing that I've only got so much time to do this. I've got to get it done. And interestingly enough, over and over and over when I get the feedback from people on this, rather than a victory, like, isn't this wonderful, he went out feeling cheated. I lost my chance to get my fix, my lust fix, not my cocaine fix or my, you follow what? Now, he went in, not having had the external cue, he went in to go to the bathroom. You know, it wasn't anything else. Or the same guy driving down the road and sees a hitchhiker, and all of a sudden that hitchhiker becomes a sexual conquest, and all now it's a whole focus. And there's really, I believe, and I think we'll find more and more about this, the studies seem to indicate, and that's all I can say is seem to indicate, because as far as I know, Carnes first wrote about this in 84, and it probably was at least 2 years later before it was even close to being accepted as a medical concept. So we're talking 86, maybe 87. So, you know, it's brand new. But Carnes and some other folks think that the closest comparison you get is the same kind of physiological thing that happens with when you ingest cocaine. That there is a difference that happens physiologically, a chemical imbalance that hits you. There's some street talk, and I'm even going to clean it up because I'm at Holden Village, but that something like a throbbing erection doesn't have any conscience. And that's really true. I mean, on the street they say that in a different way. But that when you become intensely, powerfully aroused sexually, that there is a chemical imbalance that happens, not imbalance, but there's a chemical change that happens in you, which may be somewhat comparable to getting cocaine injected. So, you know, we don't know that for sure, but we're really, really beginning to look at that. We don't know how to measure that yet, but so much of what happens seems to be the same. We do know that when we get into the cycle that I talked about, I'll show you the cycle on an overhead here in a minute, that there is an altered state of consciousness. There's no question about that. About a month ago, there was a fellow in my group who was in cycle, we call it, and he happens to be a cross-dresser. That happens to be the way he handles this dysfunction. But he was flying, and he wasn't in touch with the rest of the group. And I wish I'd had a videotape, because it was so obvious that he spent about a week in an altered hyper state where he didn't think clearly like he did other things. But at any rate, I spent just about 15 minutes talking about the first step, and I didn't mean to do that. For it to be in the addiction aspect of it, it needs to be repetitive. There needs to be, there is, an aspect of unmanageability about it. I just can't control it. I don't care to control it. I get into, so I talked about repetitive and unmanageable. And in the recipient's part, if you talk with them, there will be an aspect of it where they will tell you, I have tried this, this, and this to stop, and I can't. And that's where I get into the unmanageability. They may not say the word unmanageable, but you will hear in those 2 o'clock in the morning discussions with the tears or whatever, I tried to stop and I can't stop. There is an element of unmanageability. There is an element of remorse or shame involved in it. And that gets hard to kind of believe, like, because most of us who don't understand anything about the power of addiction really have a hard time understanding why. Look, why don't you just quit? Now, I do believe there are people who do sexually inappropriate behavior who are not addicted. I believe there are people who drink a lot who are not alcoholic. You follow me? So I'm not saying everybody who does, who goes to arcades, who makes regular usage of prostitutes, who, and you know, list all the kinds of behaviors that you want. I'm not saying everybody does that is addictive. I think a lot of folks that do that are making a choice, and that's a choice that they want to make, and if that's the choice they make, and, you know, that's their own business. I am saying there are people who are caught in that pattern, and I'm using it as a disease model, that it's no longer a choice. There are some things we can do about that, but at that point, as they view it, it's no longer a choice. So, and there is an element of remorse or shame in it. There is some kind of a cost to it, emotionally, financially, and often both. And in fact, I'd say always both, all of you. I've had guys, I had an executive tell me that he was spending, now he had a lot of money, but he said he didn't have this much money. He was spending up to $5,000 a month on out-call services where, and he got to the point because he was so fearful of AIDS that he said, I wouldn't do anything, I wouldn't touch him. I'd just have them come and talk to me or maybe take their clothes off. You know, so it was a very frustrating experience for him, but he was also scared to death of getting AIDS. And but he was caught into thousands of dollars a month. I mean, that just kind of boggles my mind. I don't make $5,000 a month. This guy was, whoo, was thinking there ought to be a better way. Enormous cost. And of course, that with that particular man, it cost him two marriages too. And I have no question, if this helps in this conversation, that this man was a fundamental, born-again, spiritual Christian who really loved both women he was married to. But it didn't work. I mean, he got in, and there was a tremendous cost to him. And then there's a tolerance, and sometimes this one's a little bit harder to see. The two things that I believe that I'm talking about are a little harder to see. One is the altered state of consciousness when you get into the ritualized behavior where you go into an altered state. And you have to get kind of sophisticated to pick that up. And the other one is the tolerance. And by tolerance, I mean it takes more to get you to the fixed point than it used to. And you can see that with drugs and alcohol. That's clear, but it's a little harder to see it, except for the fact that when someone gets at some point in time in their life, depending on when they were exposed to it, Sears catalog and the breasts that you see in National Geographic can be really sexually stimulating. And then there comes a point where that doesn't do it anymore at all. It would take, and then you begin the progression. It might take Playboy, which has certain limitations to how far it'll go. And then there are people, as you watch the progression, that Playboy won't do it anymore, but it takes Penthouse, which is farther out, and you know, there are magazines that go farther and farther out, and it takes the point where this doesn't do it anymore. I want to be careful, and I'll say that in just a minute. At any rate, those are the points that I think we have to have for it to be in this disease modality: repetitive, unmanageable, some kind of remorse or shame, a cost to it, and some level of tolerance. Now, I believe those elements cross... Is that a hand up or... Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Yes.
I hope I don't interrupt you. In treatment of alcoholism disease, there comes a point in time as one progresses in that disease, there's a crossover point where the tolerance lowers rapidly.
Exactly.
And so it only takes a whip of a bar towel.
Right. And then you can drink so much and you just never get drunk.
Right. In your experience of dealing with clients, have you seen that cross-tolerance crossover in the different patterns?
No, it's different, and as soon as I shut up here in a minute, two overheads from now, let me refer to
it
that.
It models more of the chemical dependency thing than does alcohol.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't see it ever, in this case, we break down there, I don't see it ever getting less. It's a spiraling cycle, which I see going into remission and then coming back larger, and then remission and then coming back larger. I don't ever see it breaking. So there are some breakdowns in some of the... Thank you for the question. Okay, now these elements that I talked about, I don't think have anything to do with how educated you are, or how Christian you are, or how wealthy you are. Do you follow me? That's why I say a Christian can have this. In fact, I really think maybe, now here I'm getting in deep water because I don't know this for sure, but it may be worse for a Christian. Because now, particularly if you come into a spiritual relationship and you're carrying a strong sexual addiction, you can now beat yourself up with your shame even worse because I ought to be able to pray my way out of this. I ought to be able to... And you see... Now, here's where theologically I get in trouble. Unless we have a miracle, and I don't deny that that happens. I really do believe that happens. But when you have a miracle, at least as I understand Haley's Bible commentary, and that's where I looked it up, it's breaking the laws of nature. And the laws of nature are not that you break addiction like that. That's not the way I see addiction broken. I do believe it happens sometimes. I've talked with David Wilkerson, for instance, who a number of years ago did a lot of work with kids in New York around drugs. And there were kids who would be one day heavily addicted on drugs and accept Christ, begin speaking in tongues, and stop the addiction right there. But they also will admit that a lot of kids, it didn't work that way. They've got an upstate New York home where they'll take a year to get a kid off, too. They don't pretend that it always works. Wham, right there. So I don't want to even argue about that. I want to say, if it works, wham, right there, that's great. But I'd still rather see you getting a good, strong recovery program. And getting a recovery program anyway, and work the recovery program very well. Okay. Let me refer briefly to this. Some of you that have been here before have seen this overhead, but I just want to refer briefly to it. This is a year and a half old, but it's not all that bad. And the numbers, I think the percentages would be pretty close. This is out of an EA, Employee Assistance Digest, at a conference I was at a year ago. And these numbers are taken from people who have been diagnosed by professionals. So the way they're looking at it is that you have, of course, alcoholism and alcohol abuse, 15%, 36 million people, and on down to eating addictions and other drug addictions and co-addicts, and then sex and love addictions at 6%. And I just wanted to throw that in there because I wanted to get across the concept that I'm saying that the five steps that I say for an addiction, I really want you to walk out of here thinking, well, Bill Lennon thinks that's a disease entity. Isn't that interesting? You may like that, or you may not like that, or you may want to argue that point. Now, Let me say the second piece of that. I don't think, because I believe it's a disease entity, that that makes it okay. From a clinical standpoint, we're not talking about something that's right or wrong. The closest comparison I make is diabetes. I've worked a lot with diabetic adolescents, and I just can hardly see much difference in working with it, except for the morality aspect. But from a clinical standpoint, when we get into how we treat this, and it is treatable, there are some things that we can do and that really work. But with this as a disease entity, and let me say this, that 15 years ago, if you said that about alcoholism, or maybe 20 years ago, people thought you were crazy, or you were just giving them an excuse. Now, that's different. Now, one of the reasons it's different is because we know some things we can do about helping. You know, it's a little easier to say, this is a disease, and here's how you fix it. But when we didn't know what to do about alcoholism, then it was harder to diagnose it as a disease. Now, I just found out at a conference I was at in Minneapolis, so a lot better sexual addiction, at least all the training. I don't know what that says. But I was told in a very sensitive, sharing kind of way by a person who'd just been an old-timer in the alcohol field, that the fellow, is it Bill W., that started the whole thing and is kind of, you know, kind of God in the field, and is really, really, what he's offered to alcoholics is enormously successful. But that they say, in retrospect now, it was pretty obvious that he was an untreated sexual addict. That what he did was he handled his alcoholism, but he didn't handle his sexual addiction. What I do is say, and a lot of the people who are really good at treating alcohol appreciate it when I say that. That's what they tell me anyway. If we have somebody who has a drug and alcohol addiction, I don't really know whether the primary addiction is the sexual addiction or the drug and alcohol addiction, but I know this much. You've got to treat the drug and alcohol one first. I can't work with anybody that's drinking and drugging. I can't do it. Okay? So you go get that one fixed, and when you're dry, I'll work on the other. Now, one of the other sides of that is that I'm just finished working with a guy, or he finished working with me, or he quit. He graduated our program anyway. He'd been in alcohol treatment three times. He's a voyeur. When he would get really anxious coming, after he'd get 6-8 months dry from his alcoholism, and he'd start on his rounds to go, he'd get real anxious and he'd start his patterned behavior of going around to peep in windows. He'd get so frightened because he knew he was going to get caught. Because, see, voyeurs always know they're going to get caught because they always follow the same route. I mean, it may be they'll do this route on the first Monday of the month and this route on the second Monday of the month, but within a couple, 3 years, see, they get into a ritualized behavior that's pretty obvious, and after a while, people are going to spot him. Why is that guy always in our neighborhood on Monday night? What's this all about? And he knew he was going to get caught, so he'd start drinking again to anesthetize that fear. But when he'd get into alcohol treatment, because of, and I call it the genius of the alcohol movement, they don't work with all that other stuff. They say, look, you're here to work on this, and we're going to work on this. So he'd say, but I got to worry about, and so it didn't work on that there. So in this case, I work real close with a place called Northwest Treatments and Alcohol Program in Seattle, and we work very closely together. And that's a real comfortable relationship, because the folks at Northwest Treatment and the alcohol program will say, we want to treat alcohol problems. We don't want to deal with this other stuff, because we want to stay, in a sense, pure in what we do. So then we work with it on the other side. But can you see, I don't really care which is the primary disease. I know you've got to deal with the drug and alcohol one first. Anyway, so much for this one, then, that I believe that runs pretty much across cultures and religions and so forth.
Bill?
Yes?
Two questions just that you probably will get to, but I'm wondering about. One is the sort of fundamental addictive personality or compulsive behavior, no matter what it be, the psychological underpinnings of that, whether that has to be dealt with or can be successfully dealt with that might deal with both of those problems, even if it's outside of either treatment program. And the other one is whether you're going to get to some of the origin of this stuff. You know, is it hereditary? Is it family upbringing? Is it early experiences?
The first half of your question I'm going to talk about Thursday. The second half of your question I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And a little bit of your question I'm going to talk about right now. But I don't know what that means, because there's hikes that go on up here too. But when we get stuck with 1 hour at a time, right? But let me just keep going and I'll touch some of that. Carnes, I have a lot of respect for Carnes and the work he's done, and I'll refer a lot to him. He looks at this at three levels, and he said to me one time, he said, I like this book. I'm proud that I wrote it. I took a lot of flack. He said, I know what being a martyr is all about. People made fun of me. But he said, on the other hand, I like it except for this chart. So I wish I'd never put it in there. I'll tell you why. And he said, if you're going to use my chart, at least do this for me and explain it. The thing that's really crucial to understand here is level one, level two, level three. Any of these may be addictive behaviors. But it's really important to understand that the way our minds tend to work is that it looks like you go from level one to level two and from level two to level three, and you don't. That does not happen. You may have a level one problem, a level two problem, and or a level three problem. You could have all three. But you don't have one down to this, down to this. Now, we got a lot of bad press, those of us that are working in this arena, because Ted Bundy and a lot of his, whatever he was doing, tried to imply, I think, and I watched those tapes a lot, that he had an addiction to pornography. I believe Ted Bundy did. And because of his addiction to pornography, he moved down into these other things. That's baloney. Unless Ted Bundy was one unique human being different from everybody else in the world. What I believe about that is that Ted Bundy had these problems that started at this level and worked horizontally up to worse and worse and worse and worse. Do you follow me? And he had some pornography problems that worked worse and worse and worse. So it's not linear, it's horizontal. You can have one of these and be increasingly, and it will be increasingly, if it's not treated and the pattern broken, it will get worse and worse and worse. It never goes back. I tell people that I work with in the program, it's like being on an escalator going the wrong way. You can't stand still, because if you stand still, you're going downhill. The addict always works in passivity. When you're working your program, you've got a chance. Can't guarantee it, but you've got a chance. But if you become passive and don't do something actively, it will get worse and worse and worse. And 5 years from now, it will be worse than it is now. And 10 years from now, it will be worse than it is. I've worked with people that have been into some of these kind of patterns for 50 years. And they may have dormancy of 5-10 years, and they come back into it. And they come back. So is that making some sense? There may be someone who has a problem with compulsive masturbation, and that may be the only problem that they've got. And let me tell you, that can be an incredible problem. If it's in your mind a problem, and you do that once a week or once a day, then you've got a problem with the fact that perceptually, I think this is a horrible thing for me to be doing, and I can't stop myself, and it's repetitive, and you see all that. And I work with people, I'm working with a fellow right now who averages about 6 times a day. And he's a professional person. I can't keep his mind on his work. You see what I'm saying? It's shaming to him. He gets too anxious. He slips away from whatever he's doing and goes into the bathroom and masturbates and comes back. Or people who will go to the arcades. We developed at our clinic the Tukwila syndrome. And we call it the Tukwila syndrome because I didn't know what else to call it, but it got across the point. He would drive from where he lived on the east side, this was 3-4 years ago, to where he was working and he had to drive along the freeway exit past where the arcades were in Seattle, or down on 1st and 2nd Avenue. Any of you know Seattle? Any of you know Seattle? And now this might sound like a joke, but he said when he'd get to the turnoff to go down there, it was almost like the wheel had a life of its own. And he had one of two things to do, either turn down and go into the arcades, or just hang on with every ounce of strength that he'd got to get through that stretch of road. And then when he'd get through, instead of having this wonderful feeling of euphoria and I won, he'd just feel cheated. I lost. I didn't go get my fix. So I would draw circles for him. That's why I call it the Tuck Willis syndrome, because part of what I want to get into the treatment on Friday, but I'd say, okay, here's where the problem is, and there's where you've got to go, and this is where you are. How far do you have to go away from there not to get that pull? So we figured he'd have to drive from his house all the way to Tuck Willis and all the way around. And if you can kind of, because I think in a lot of visual metaphors, if you kind of think of a whirlpool, you know, when you're close, you get sucked in. But if you're way out here in the calm water, it doesn't mean that you don't want to do it. But the pull isn't as strong. And secondarily, and I'll talk about this in a minute, you don't get into the altered state of consciousness where you get into a distorted reality. Now that sounds spooky, but it really does happen in this altered state of consciousness. So, level one basically, except, well, it does in the sense of it's illegal to see a prostitute, but basically this is not breaking laws, generally. Always this is breaking laws. And these are in the middle. Clinically, when I'm working with somebody, that part of it doesn't make any difference. What makes a difference to me is back to the 5 points of the definition. How repetitive is it? How fast is the cycle increasing? Do you see what I'm saying? So, although we do divide our program into level ones and level twos, are all in fact, just because, I don't know, nomenclature, we call it level one groups. And the level threes are in a totally different group. You want to ask a question?
Yeah, I just for clarity, you do believe in healthy use of masturbation?
Yes and no. That's an absolute definite maybe. I do believe in healthy use of masturbation, you said. Personally, I see absolutely nothing wrong with masturbation. I think it's a... You'll never hear me say anything negative about it. I also drink beer. And I don't have any problem drinking beer. I don't have any alcoholism. I don't have any issues. But I know a whole lot of people that can't drink beer because it's part of a pattern that gets them in trouble. And I work with a whole lot of people that can't masturbate. Not because masturbation in and of itself, in my view, has anything wrong with it, but because for some people it's now become part of a cycle or a pattern in which they get themselves into trouble. So for those folks, I don't believe they can do it any more than I think some folks can do a little cocaine or a little marijuana. Do you see?
I see what you mean, but I think masturbation especially was wrapped up with the years that the church said this was the worst thing in the world. You will die if you masturbate. You know, stuff.
At least
like
your hands will fall off or something.
Right.
Well, yes.
Right. So I think that the early conditioning of people who thought that was such a terrible thing are some of the things that would bring on all the shame. And
I couldn't agree with you more. Totally, totally, totally. And yet I still have to answer that after when we work in therapy, and I'll talk more about that Thursday, when we work in therapy with people on this, one of our many goals in therapy is get them to the point where they can see that there's some things I can do and there's some things I can't do. And that's okay. And that doesn't mean I'm a bad person, it just means it doesn't work for me. And that the entity in itself is not bad, but I'll go back to the other thing that, and I don't know, in a place like this, maybe that's not okay for me to say. But for me, I don't have a problem with alcohol. I don't have a problem using it in moderation, and I don't have a problem with it chemically. It doesn't do things to me. And so I'll just stay with that example. Yes, Bill?
I just wonder, in your practice, have you investigated the idea that many of the problems in industry where a person makes use of a foreign assistance program or does not make use of it, but is tagged as one who is a sexual harasser on the job, is that not something that's managed to do or possibly indicate of?
Overwhelmingly, yes. Yes, overwhelmingly, yes. In fact, we go in and we have a lot of companies. We have an employee assistance company, and we have a lot of companies that will ask us to once or twice a year come in and do a drug and alcohol thing. And we say, we also need to do this thing on sexual addiction and sexual. Well, I don't know if we want that, but you know, it's not easy to sell. It's not easy to sell in the churches. I work a lot with churches. I work a lot with pastors. Most of my work with churches and pastors is after something has already happened. This is the second place I've ever been where I've been asked to come in and do something before it's happened with a church. I mean, not that this is a church, but you know what I mean? That's just not what we do. Now, I get real involved with pastors and churches after things have blown up. But to go in and talk to the personnel committee and use Marie Fortune's model of this is how you handle it, both for restoration for the community, but also for restoration for the pastor, and to go in and help people set all that up, well, I don't know. You know, that's new territory. That's why one of the reasons I was excited to come up here, because, I said it. I want to bypass these parts right here for now, just because of time. But I want to run to the addict's core belief system. I want to talk some about the addict, the person. And here I'm referring more to males, and I really believe it's not more male than female. And one thing I want to say, and I hope I remember to say this tonight at the forum or whatever this thing is we're going to do, this is not a hetero or a homosexual issue. Does that make sense? We're talking about whether your sexual behavior is out of control or not. We're not talking about what you do when it gets out of control. Another thing it's not is it's not a genital issue. It's an inadequacy issue. It's a power issue. It's an up here issue. I tell the folks I work with, this thing is a disease, and it's a disease of intimacy and an inability to develop an area of intimacy. It doesn't mean the person can't develop intimacy at all. I don't mean that. But it is a disease of intimacy rather than a disease of the genitals. So I say to folks, this one's between your ears. It's not between your legs. Interestingly enough, then people talk about what they're going to cut or do some kind of, you know, just makes me cringe, because cutting something off of somebody, castration or something, that's not going to change anything, because these issues are here. This is an image that I'm lacking, and I can correct that lack by something I do sexually, which never works, by the way. Okay, the addict's core belief system. Basic belief: I'm a bad person, I'm an inadequate person, I'm an unworthy person, I'm a flawed person. There's something that I missed. Now, this can get terribly confused. This can get terribly confused. I'll tell you why this can get terribly confused. Particularly if we get into the narcissistic personality or different folks who often fall into this. This person may be such a scrambler that they're the best teacher you've got. They're the best youth pastor you've ever seen. They're the best coach you've got. You see what I'm saying? There's a drive internally to overcome. But deep down, this person really doesn't feel that good about themselves. They're not at peace. They don't really believe they got as much to bring to the table as other folks. And there's some real pain around that. Second thing was, no one would love me as I am, which often fits right into the first core belief. And in terms of treatment, which I'll talk about Thursday, one of the things we have to do is shift all four of these core beliefs to a more positive thing. And I think we can do that. We can do it in groups. We can't do it individually. But No one would love me as I am. That's where we get into the secrecy thing that I just inferred a little bit last night. I say to folks, and I just believe this wholeheartedly, I can't guarantee if you break all your secrets, all the problems are going to go away. But I'll guarantee one thing, if you don't break the secrets, the problems will stay. This whole thing is built in and on secrecy. Let me say to you, it may be hard to believe, but that if you are with someone, married to someone, just meeting someone, and there's a whole secret life around sexuality, it doesn't mean that the rest of the life that they weren't really there. It doesn't mean that they aren't caring, sensitive human beings who want life to be as much loving and at peace as you do. But there's a core, there's a strata, there's a compartmentalized piece that from a tiny, tiny time, they believed they had to keep secret. In the secrecy, there's a shame that happens. In the secrecy, there's a power that happens. And it's like this thing keeps me isolated from you so I can never really become intimate with you. So what we've got is this person that wants to get intimate and can't because I got this big secret. And it's really based on the idea that I'm kind of poopy anyway. And if I really told you what the bottom line was about my sexual stuff, and that's the other thing I was referring to last night in Vespers, that if I was jacking around my income tax, I might be embarrassed, but I might tell you. But I'm not going to tell you some of my sexual stuff because, now this is an interesting thing. Some of the sexual stuff that you hear when you get groups going is really, really raw and pretty awful. But you know, some of it is, it's like, big deal. Okay, so you went, now I'm not going to give you an example because then you'll think, well, he calls that a big deal. I think that's horrible. So I don't want to get into that. But, you know, you did something that doesn't seem that unusual. But you see, because you're working in a secret world, you don't have a perspective. You don't even know what's normal. So you just think it's awful. And then the awful just keeps building. Third one is, my needs are never going to be met if I have to depend on others. So bottom line, down to it, whatever I use to get my dysfunctional sexual fix, you with me? I got to do it by myself. This may be masturbation, this may be picking up hookers, this may be going to arcades, this may be whatever. But I got to do it by myself because nobody's ever really going to come through for me. And the fourth one is that sex is my most important need, and need is the key word here. I lose the perspective of what I want and what I need, and I think in my distorted stinking thinking that I got to have it. And I keep going for it and going for it and going for it. It never really quite works. And what I may not realize is that I'm going to shift my order here for a second. What I may not realize is that the ritual is where I get into my altered state of consciousness. And I may not realize, number one, that I ever get into an altered state of consciousness, and number two, that my altered state of consciousness is where my primary turn-on is. Now, here's again where we break down, say, from cocaine. Because I believe that someone can get, I don't know, I've never done cocaine, but I've got a foster son that tells me that, Bill, don't ever try it. Because if you want to talk about a 20-minute orgasm, it is so scary because it's so wonderful. And I know I like good things, so I'm not going to try it because I'd better not get around something that would be that phenomenal. But you see, I believe maybe, just from what I've been told, that when that high hits from cocaine, the high may be that good itself. But that's where we break down here. Because the high that comes out of the ritual. Only lots of folks don't realize it. The guy who's voyeuring, who's cruising, who's looking, that's where he's high. When he picks somebody up, invariably it's kind of flat, particularly after he ejaculates. Because he didn't feel proud of himself, he didn't like it. It's never really that good. What's really good is when he gets into the altered state. And here's what happens. And when you're working from a codependent standpoint, that's why I put this part. The questions, you can just look at them. We don't have time to get into them that much today, but I just wanted to get the four steps. Preoccupation, ritual, behavior, and despair. The preoccupation begins to build. for the addict. Now, the preoccupation may be storing up what we call lustful looks, because we work a lot on lustful looking. We work a lot on taking things to a low level of behavior. I work everything like, again, I'm getting into the treatment stuff, but we work everything like being on a roller coaster. And actually, the last roller coaster I was on was when we were up at, not that that matters, but up at the World's Fair up in Canada. But that thing comes down, and you know what? It kind of bucks, and it gets real slow right at the bottom. Well, you can step off then. If you're real scared, you can step off. But when it gets part way up, it's probably doubtful. And that Hummer gets up to the top, forget it. You're not going to get off. You're going to go through with it. Because now everything is charged up, and you've really... Wow, that's an interesting point. The Fly, the movie. You begin to preoccupy. Now, there's a Russian neuropsychologist named Luria who did, some fascinating things about the brain. And what he says is that when you have an experience or a memory in the brain, it makes a groove. And that when you pattern that groove many, many times, I mean, that experience, the groove gets heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier. And then imagine if you pattern that also with erections, with ejaculation. You see how that groove just gets deeper and deeper? So I view it like having a stylus on a record. And if you drop the stylus into the groove, it's going to play the same song. So we've got to keep the stylus out of the groove. That's real important to build in patterns in your recovery. But the preoccupation starts happening, and maybe you're glancing and you're thinking, and it begins to build up inside you, and I'm having to hurry now. But from there, it moves into a ritualism. Sometimes it's easy to see in a voyeur. It's not easy to see sometimes. But we work on what we call our snake, and it's kind of symbolic. We have our people in treatment work on what are the early signs of when you're preoccupying. Maybe you're getting a little depressed. Maybe things didn't go well at work. Maybe there's a physician I worked with who, on the fourth 12-hour day that he'd work, you could figure he'd act out. He'd get tired when he got too tired. And I'd say to him, you know that's going to happen. You know that's death to you inside. But it's my job, and I like my job. But you know what it's going to do to you when you get overtired. You're going to go into the preoccupation and the ritual. Maybe you got to work in another job. Do you see what I'm saying? But I don't want to work in another, so we'd go round and round. But and you move. There is a ritual that you get into. The ritual is where you get into the altered state. From the ritual, you move to the behavior of masturbating or starting another affair or doing whatever, picking up a prostitute. After the behavior comes the despair, the remorse, the shame. Bradshaw talks about, he defines something, I think, real nicely, and I really believe it. Shame is what I am, and guilt is what I do. I like that, because when it's shame, I don't believe it's what I am, but it's what I've begun to think I am. And my addict says, I got you. It's like screw tape letters. Now I've got you shamed. And so, you know, it's like people that binge eat. Well, you might as well just go for it, because you've screwed up anyway, and you're filled with shame, and so you go ahead and hit with guilt. Guilt's a good thing, because you can get out of guilt. That's just something I did, and I can say I'm sorry, and I can get out of it. But shame is where all these secrets are. So the bottom line of this thing is somehow we've got to confront, support, demand, challenge, set a safe setting. Maybe we set up something in Holden where people can come, where pastors can come, whatever. Do you see what I'm saying? Where it's okay to talk about this stuff and begin to break that, because the despair, somebody asked me last week, is the despair genuine? You better believe it's genuine. You better believe it. They don't want to do this. They hate it. The tears come down. They'll ask you, what kind of a person do you think I am? You know, and they really just, it's just awful until the preoccupation starts. Once the preoccupation starts, you start getting fired up again. begin thinking about it, building to it. Now remember I said you may build to it in 30 seconds or a minute or 2 minutes. Walk into the bathroom, there's the magazine. Wham! Here goes my cycle. And I jump right into it. We would tell the guy, you know what I'd say to somebody that it's in the program right there? What's your answer? And they'd spit it out so fast, say, the minute I saw the magazines, out the door, right now, because I know I'm in a place I can't handle. And I can't go places where I can't handle. I would say to most alcoholics, I think, don't go hang out in bars. That's not too smart. You know, don't be a bartender. That doesn't work too good for you. So anyway, preoccupation, ritual, behavior, and despair, and I didn't get quite as far as I meant to, but we're done. I'm sorry, I don't even get to answer questions. We all get to go to lunch, and I'll answer a couple, but tape ministry people, we're finished. So, kind of fast, isn't it? Want to ask me something, or?
Are you working in Seattle, did you say?
Actually, our practice is in Bellevue.
In Bellevue?
Uh-huh.
Who are you with? Out of the Kirkland, I'm curious.
Well, I'm with a place called Bellevue Community Services. It's been a marriage, child, and family practice for 17 years now. And this is part of what we do, and it's not all of what we do. Thank goodness.
I'm just curious if you might know
Well, we work with St. Luke's all the time. We're in the same building complex, and yeah, we work, and we're doing more and more with St. Luke's. We do a lot with St. Luke's. Yep. Charlie Thompson is the chemical dependency guy down at the care unit, and Charlie and I are putting together an intensive program for this guy. We have a 1 day a week thing, and Charlie and I are putting together a program where we'll have people that are more intensively involved for 4 days a week, but still not ready to go in the hospital. Insurance won't cover you in the hospital anymore.
No.
Yes.
About
time out. Let me answer. His behind you, because I pointed at you and you thought I was meeting you.
Okay.
Just real quick, you see strong lines of correlation between parts of your journey and the devil's journey of alcoholism.
Karn says, the question was, do I see strong lines between ACOA behavior and this? Karn says he thinks between 60 and 70%. That's what they're finding in the hospital. I keep referring to Karn's. They have an inpatient program that we refer to at Golden Valley. And he says 60 to 70%. This is ACOA stuff all over the place.
Yeah.